ache, and I thought it was for sex, but it's to tear everything to fucking pieces. But enough about my problems. Hello and welcome to episode 164. Is that right?
Yep.
Yep, good. Of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other thrice-damned dog creatures as masterpieces. I am Nick. I am the prepubescent teen of this episode, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
I guess I'm the experienced sergeant who's played by a real actor.
I wonder if that would be...
We'll get on to that.
We'll come on to that. This is episode 3 of our werewolf extravaganza. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a good...
Possibly werewolf-a-thon.
Werewolf-a-thon, yeah, that's probably better. Our scary, hairy, how dare he... anyway, I'm getting distracted myself. We are coming bang up to date by episodes from the 2000s, which seems very recent to me.
We've jumped forward another 20 years, and we're still 20 years ago.
Yeah, oh my God, that's depressing. But we have... So, our previous episodes, we talked about werewolf films from the 40s, and then the 80s, and now we're doing the... Do we still call them the noughties? I always hated this.
We never did.
No, yeah, fair enough. Anyway, from the period between 2000 and, well, 2002 in this case, and we will start off with, I guess we'll do them in chronological order.
Yeah, might as well.
A Canadian film. I don't know if we've had a Canadian film before,
as opposed to ones filmed in Canada, which is much more.
Oh yeah, we've had plenty of those, but this is a proper written and directed and acted in by people from the land of Canada, and it is 2000's Ginger Snaps, which is a, well, it's a werewolf movie. It's got, it's a kind of a, well, to me, there's a lot of vibes of Heathers in it, a lot of vibes of The Craft, in that it is a lot about the school experience as an outsider, and a lot about the female experience going through puberty as well.
Also, I think it's, you know, the Craft is explicitly saying school is hell and there is magic. This, I think, is getting closer to being, this is a metaphor for the school experience. Sometimes it can't entirely support that, but I think that's what it's trying to do. There's an odd imbalance here, because the director, I think it may have been his second feature film. It was something
John
like that.
John Fawcett, we should say.
Yeah, and the writer had done some TV episodes. That sort of level of experience. It's not quite very...
Aaron Walton.
Yeah, not quite very first experience, but close to it. Whereas the two stars, in spite of their being quite young, were seriously experienced actors. You know, they'd started as actual children, and you know, they were several years into their careers at this point.
They were the seasoned veterans of the film.
At the very least, I would guess that they had a lot of input into how the characters were played, as distinct from what they said.
The acting here from both the leads. So this is two sisters. Emily Perkins and Catherine Isabel, I think, playing Ginger and Bridget.
Yeah.
And despite the title of the film, I guess it's really Bridget's...
The title Bridget's of the film is a full of... sentence.
Ginger Snaps, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Like Plums Deify. Or... Anyway, yes. the story is to... kids growing up in suburbia, Canadian town.
Ontario, yeah, well, maybe. That was interesting. We start with an aerial shot, and I'm very used to seeing aerial shots of American suburbia. And yes. Immediately this was, no, this is different.
You know,
these are proper two-story houses, and they're in rows and things like that. They don't have these huge yards outside them.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I this was filmed largely in Canada, on location, in the sense of we went out the back of our offices and found the nearest place that would let us film. So
it's not a high budget movie. In fact, neither are movies we're talking about particularly high budget. But it starts so we have two quite alienated I mention prepubescent because it's a point of the story that despite them being 15, 16?
About that.
They haven't actually started menstruating yet, and much to their mother's disappointment. And they're very, I guess that they're very, the craft-like, or Heather's-like in that they are alienated from their normal surroundings and they're alienated at school. They're the weirdos. They're cool school project. And it's a great way. It starts with the discovery of a dog that's been ripped apart by a werewolf, which is an interesting start. But then we get this great start of the sisters who, for their school project, have basically done a bunch of different suicides as an art project,
mm-hmm.
Which is very... I mean, in a way, it feels a bit done now, but it was very much of its time. That was the sort of this kind of Buffy feel of rebellious... school angst, but it's really well done.
But also, as we're probably going to say repeatedly, so I mean, just mentally insert this after every sentence, the actors sell it.
Absolutely, yeah, the acting of the two leads, Bridget and Ginger, is possibly better than some of the other acts in it, but it's really good. Well, that's a bit mean, actually.
Well, we do spend most of our time with them. So they get more time to develop as well.
I did feel like the mum was maybe a bit oversold as being... I mean, you've got to not like her. This film does a good
maybe
job
Rogers,
of getting...
Maybe Rogers, please note.
Oh.
Not on some random woman they pulled in off the street. I do think they're trying for the black comedy, maybe in the same kind of vein as The Lost Boys, you know, mum doesn't really understand, but is trying to be cool and failing.
What? Well, that might lead us into one of the problems of the film, I think, in that whereas Heather's really manages to flip from black comedy to tragedy, it's like I remember thinking Heather's is one of the darkest films I've ever seen, but it manages to sell it quite well. I'm not sure it gets the balance right here, but maybe we'll talk about that later. What happens to them is that we get some vignettes basically of how their life is at school, and it's all, I mean, your sympathies are on their side quite quickly. They are the underdogs. They've got each other and that's about it. So they have this suicide pact. So it's all very dark, very emo, I guess you would have in modern day. Is emo modern day? I'm so old. I don't know. but they go, I forget the sequence of events, but they go to a party and soon afterwards Ginger starts her periods. And
there is no particularly significance to this. It just happens to be then.
But the significance of her having a period is then she's immediately, presumably, I don't know, in the sort of, in the not metaphor part of the film, this is because it's attracted to the scent of blood. It's a pretty... I'm on shaky ground here. I am not biologically female. I have never had to experience menstruation.
I have never been a teenage girl.
Yes, exactly. And so I don't... I think it is good for films. Well, it definitely is good because it's a thing... You know, people just don't talk about, even in the medical profession, even though half of the world experiences the menstrual cycle. And it's just, it's almost never a plot point. So I don't want to dismiss it. I think it is, you know, this is a thing that all girls go through. But from this point on, it feels like quite a heavy-handed metaphor for puberty. For
well, in particular, at the point where the creature attacks them, well, specifically when it bites Ginger, spoiler.
Yes,
Bridget has just as much blood on her.
Yes.
So on the metaphorical level, that's a, it is specifically because Ginger is menstruating rather than just the scent of blood.
Yes, and so on the and then we, yes, and what happens? Unlike other werewolf films, where. I mean, as we've established, all werewolf films are different and all the rules, just like all vampire films, all the rooms are slightly different and the film has to establish the rules. In this werewolf film, the rules are you don't turn into a werewolf once a month. You slowly, over the course of a month, transform into a werewolf.
Mm.
Permanently, as far as we can tell. but we don't know. The Beast is killed by the local, the other kind of high school dropout who's a drug dealer, because he hits it with his car. And from this point on, Ginger, so we've had this bond established between Ginger and Bridget. And then from, then we get these two parallel stories, but we don't see it so much from Ginger's point of view, which in a way is a shame, because I feel like if this is a metaphor for the transformation you undergo in puberty, and I think it kind of has to be, it's pretty explicit there. We don't really see it from Ginger's point of view. We see it from Bridget's point of view as how Ginger suddenly changes.
Yeah, so it, the, on the metaphorical level there, it's more my big sister suddenly got interested in clothes and boys and isn't fun anymore.
Yes, that's very much what's happening here. So, and that's exactly what happens to Ginger. She becomes kind of at once more interested in sex, or thinks she is, and sexualized, but also over the course of the film, more kind of physically repulsive. And I feel like that is... again, these are expressing, you know, the feelings and things you go through with menstruation, but it's really the increasing alienation of Bridget from her sister and how things change. Mm. And so it is interesting. I'm not sure quite what it's trying to say, and I feel a little bad for saying that, because maybe it doesn't have to be saying anything. We just don't see this kind of thing portrayed on film very often, and it probably is speaking, as you say, to people who are or were teen girls more than it is to me. And it's, I guess that would be comforting if you're going through a similar thing to realise other people are going through it too.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is momentum, because I don't mean in terms of things happening, because things are happening, but in terms of the progress of the plot, you know, almost immediately post-turning, we've got the idea that Ginger is now a bit different and... Yes. Is isolated from Bridget and so on. And that's more or less where we are also in the final scene. It's gradually getting more so, but there isn't any, wasn't much to make that progress more interesting.
I agree. It's, I think that is also behind my kind of feeling of, well, what's it trying to say then? Because it sort of says, yes, this happens and this is what it feels like.
I mean, as far as messages go, you could easily claim that one of the messages is puberty is horrifying, and even your well-meaning female relatives and female authority figures cannot really help with this, because while they are saying reassuring things, they are not accepting the horrifyingness of it.
You know, we have that scene with the counsellor where she's trying to reassure Ginger, and it's just so badly, you know, I'm sure lots of people have been in that experience. So it's interesting.
Which would be fine if it were just, oh, this thing has happened that I've been expecting for ages, and now here's how it goes. But because she can't relate to the horrifyingness of it,
yes,
the whole thing falls flat. But you could also say the other message would be sibling loyalty has its limits. You know, there comes a point where Bridget has to say, okay, I am not just going to do the thing that Ginger wants because Ginger wants it.
Yes. Well, it's where it works, I think, the film, it's it's Bridget's kind of... Bridget undergoes more of a transformation, but even then it's quite a passive... Well, no, she doesn't undergo more of a transformation, but her kind of... She has to become sort of stand on her own two feet and become an independent person. Mm. And I guess if anything changes, that's what changes. But it's kind of forced upon her by Ginger just sort of dumping her and changing physically and emotionally. Again, absolutely, as you say, this is totally sold by the acting, which is really good on both their fronts.
The thing is, you can argue that the film is trying to send either or both of those messages, but I don't think it ever actually really digs into them very much. And that I think is a failure of scripting.
Yeah, I'm aware. Again, I'm not female, and it would be nice to have a, you know, maybe Marianne's perspective a bit on it. But it feels like it says it and then doesn't quite do anything with it. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't really explore it so much as it's a bit like one of those stand-up comics who says, you know, this happened to me. Isn't it terrible the way this happened? It doesn't do anything with it. They're just telling you what happened.
Well, also, perhaps I was just too much in sympathy with the girls, but when we were supposed to have moments of bat comedy, I was sympathising too much with them really to find it funny. But that's a me problem, I suspect.
No, I totally agree. The black comedy area, And I think it is going for black comedy, but the fact that I'm not 100% sure, in a way that we're...
Oh, the counsellor, most of the stuff with Mom.
Yes, in a way where Heather's worked earlier on, I haven't mentioned American Werewolf, because that's also got moments of black comedy, which I think worked less well for you than for me, but I think worked better than they do here regardless, because it's just... even though you're still sympathetic with David in American Werewolf in London, it's a hard line to walk, kind of black comedy and caring about the characters. And it didn't, as you say, I cared too much about the characters, to find it funny, but also by the end, it sort of ditches, I mean, it kind of has to logically following the story, but it sort of ditches the metaphor in that Ginger is now an out-and-out werewolf, and it's very hard to keep up, you know, that this is what menstruation is like when you're a teenager, this is what having a period is like. No, actually, she's a killing machine.
It drops the metaphor completely when it's, you know, there is this possible cure.
Yes, the Belladonna injections. Wolfsbane injections, sorry.
Which, yeah, I can... It's that thing with the tragedy, you know, Bridget were in fact able to administer the injection, then things would be a lot happier. But from the way these people are, it couldn't happen. It wouldn't be a satisfying ending, even if it were a happy one.
But you're right. Of course, apparently you find out, because there was both a prequel and a sequel to this, and in the sequel, it turns out the Wolfsbane thing is a temporary cure. You still transform; it just slows you down.
Mm. I heard very positive things about this from various reviewers. I was frankly a bit surprised that I wasn't transported my letters the way I was meant to be.
Well, I have seen Ginger Snaps before and enjoyed it many years, I think when it came out. And I liked it well enough. I liked it quite a lot back then. And I guess this time I agree, it just didn't quite land for me. I don't want to say the metaphor was too obvious. I really do think these things should be seen and explored. You know, it's good for girls to have role models or at least characters on screen going through what they go through. But I don't know where it goes with that really, because as you say, at the end of the film, it's just a monster movie. I think that's a really good point. You know, there is no metaphorical equivalent of having your period cured by an injection. Short of puberty suppressants, but you know, I don't think that's what the film was trying to talk about.
Yeah. I think we should possibly talk about its effects. So this film is doing the sensible thing for a low budget film that needs to have effects, which is it's mostly keeping them in the shadows.
Yes.
They clearly know their effects are a bit rubbish. I will confess that I grew up on Doctor Who, all right? I don't mind a bad effect. I did find the wolf in the final scene a bit distractingly bad.
I mean, it was obviously partly choice and partly style, but it's kind of a strange kind of... doesn't really look... I guess it is sort of a wolf-human hybrid, but it's... Yeah, I agree. It's not particularly frightening. I'm not quite sure what it is. But, yeah, I won't go on about them too. But, you know, we have just been spoiled by, you know, Rick Baker... effects.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say this is a bad film. It's clearly trying to be something rather more than it is, and maybe if it had just tried to be a straight exploitation, it might have succeeded better. But as it is, there's that sense of, oh, you almost got that here.
Yeah, again, this film passes the Bechdel test with flying colours, which we haven't talked about for a while.
To next episode.
or the two after that, I think about it. Goodness me, in fact, we may have the biggest failure. And coming out anyway, remind me to talk about that next episode. It's lovely to have two strong female characters brilliantly acted. It's lovely to talk about these issues or at least portray them on screen. I think whatever your metaphor is, it's got to work as a story as well. And I think, it fails for me a bit. In the progression of the story, I was moved at the end a bit, but not now. Again, I was distracted by the effects of the wolf. I'm not going to die in this room with you. I think ultimately I'm waffling around the fact it's no masterpiece from my point of view.
I wanted to love it, and I quite liked it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I'm all for more strong female characters and female stories. But as a sort of straight monster movie, werewolf movie, it's not the best one we've seen. It's not the worst either. That was the Wolfman. yeah, okay. I think I have nothing more to say about
that. Let us move on 2 years to 2002's Dog Soldiers. First feature.
Neil Marshall's debut feature. He's gone on to do a lot of things since then, one of which was loved. Most of the other things everybody absolutely hates.
But I think probably best known for The Descent at this point.
Well, The Descent came after Dog Soldiers.
Now rather than 2002.
This is the very opposite of a female film.
It's got a female character in it.
It has got a female character. We'll talk about that because it is interesting. But this is a very manly... Now, I'll say outright, for some reason, I don't know what it says about me, some of my favourite films are manly men being manly together. And what I mean by that, I don't mean like Brokeback Mountain. Though I do like Brokeback Mountain. Jaws, the camaraderie of the men on the boat, I love. The Man Who Would Be King, my other one of my favourite films, the camaraderie of those friends. So not manly men being manly together, but the camaraderie of men. I don't know why. So this film seems tailor-made for me because this is a group of manly men being camaraderious together.
But first, Liam Cunningham.
Yes, Liam Cunningham.
is one of those faces I've recognised. I can't actually tell you anything else he's been in.
Well, I know him more recently. Liam Cunningham was the Onion Knight in Game of Thrones, and that's where he basically cemented himself like that in my head, and I'd forgotten he'd been in other things first. So here he plays so we have a group of soldiers on manoeuvres up in the... Are they in the Scottish Highlands?
Yes.
Kevin McKidd is the soldier who had attempted to join the SAS or some other elite regiment.
They always call it Special Forces.
Special Forces. He succeeds, he hides, but then he's asked to shoot a dog in the head by Liam Cunningham, who is the most villainous of villainy villains in this film that I've seen for quite some time.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say he is at least a bit wasted here. There are bits where he has to act and he comes through in spades, but a lot of the time he is kind of pantomime villain.
Yeah, there's a lot of slices of ham when he's on the screen. He's really, I mean, everyone here has a British accent. So to be properly villainous, of course, you need a British accent in a film. So he has to have the most upper class posh British accent to stand out from all the other British accents, just to indicate that he is the villain. And it did lose me a bit in that scene where he's like, you've got to shoot the dog. It just felt like a bit forced.
I would point out from my own personal knowledge of people who have been in that I can't say there wouldn't be an officer like that if he thought he could get away with it, but it is absolutely not the institutional culture.
Exactly, yeah. It feels, and I guess the point is he's supposed to be a bit extreme, but it didn't quite... It felt a bit filmy rather than realistic. But then the film gets a lot better because Sean Pertwee crops up.
before that, we get Roger's Aviation Corner. Sorry.
Oh, lovely. Okay, let's get Roger's
All right, no, it's Nagusta 109 dropping off this small team of explicitly regular army blokes.
Yes. Okay.
Led by Sean Pertwee. Otherwise known as this film's real actor who gets screen time.
Sean Pertwee makes this film. He is he Sergeant Wells? He's a sergeant, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a sergeant.
Yeah.
He is a proper actor. He's immediately likable. He's got, I don't know, just
he,
something
he
about
is doing that
present.
Thing that Michael Caine sometimes does of he's trying not to steal the scene, but he does it anyway simply because he is acting and the rest of them are trying to act.
Well, so we're introduced to the soldiers, and they have this kind of realistic, it's not quite Tarantino-esque, but they're just shooting the shit. they're very familiar with each other, and the dialogue is that kind of realistic style. As a Brit, this is how Brits talk to each other when they're good mates, and particularly when they're manly good mates, and they're, you know, casually insulting each other. And
yeah, it feels very realistic to me.
Yeah, yeah, it is nicely done. I get the feeling, however, that we're supposed to be sort of getting to know all the characters. Now, I remember Kevin McKidd's... Oh, I can't remember his name. Kevin McKidd's character,
This is Cooper. Kevin McKidd, yeah, Cooper.
Cooper, and I remember Wells. And then we have some other interchangeable soldiers. Honestly, I can't... I know they're given the odd character trait, but they don't quite stick out in my mind generally. Was that your experience?
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah. Their theoretical job is cross this bit of rough country, and there is a simulated enemy position over here, and then do assault that position.
Back in time for tea.
Mm-hmm. It would be tea and medals, but it is only an exercise. it is specifically stated that the position is held by Special Forces troops. Quite what this small squad is meant to do against a half brick of SAS is not entirely clear, but it may well be, you know, see how well you do, and they will shout at you for not doing better.
See how well you cope when you're facing overwhelming odds, something like that. The British Koyabashi Maru, is that right?
Koyashi.
Thank you, that one. but they don't pass the Kirk test. Or they don't have to, because when they get there... So this is a first screenplay for Neil Marshall. It feels a bit like it to me, and there's lots of... the dialogue's really good, but there are lots of moments where people are, like, showing... I've read this Wikipedia page. it's like zooms in on the character and they tell their story. Now, Sean Pertwee, when he does it about his mate who's been blown to pieces, and they find his tattooed bit that was protected and the devil. It's a slightly silly story, but Sean Pertwee sells it because he's a great actor, or he's got great screen presence. But when other characters try to, there's a bit later on when they're defending the farmhouse and one chap's talking about Rourke's Drift, and I just feel like
it doesn't carry it, but yeah, Sean Pertwee has this thing about, you know, being a professional soldier and what that means, and again he sells that because he's Sean Pertwee.
Yes, but there are lots of these little scenes that just feel like I don't know why I don't particularly get on with Kevin McKidd as the hero. I don't know,
he's
something
okay
about him. Yeah, I suppose I just
I didn't find myself objecting to him, but I did find myself wondering when Sean Pertwee was going to be back on screen.
Well, so they find the Special Forces encampment, which has been ripped to shreds with a dying Liam Cunningham, clearly about to drop dead, Liam Cunningham.
Salt survivor, yeah.
It feels a little convoluted. Oh no, the radio has stopped working. Their radio has been shot to pieces, so we can't summon any help. And where in the UK is, like, I know it's in the Scottish Highlands, but I think they say they're like 4 hours drive from the nearest shop or something.
Well, there are some pretty bad roads in that area.
There are, but she's on a good road when they find her.
Hey, yeah. Far...
Anyway, they realise there's something else in the area. Spoilers, it's werewolves. There's werewolves in the area. And Liam Cunningham, the rules for this werewolf movie are that once you get bitten, you become a werewolf over the course of the next few hours. You also get fantastic healing powers, we discover, over time. And these werewolves are near invulnerable to damage, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, being casually shot doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
Yes, exactly. So the soldiers who had all blanks find the Special Forces didn't have blanks, I think, for some reason. And so they load up on ammo and equipment, and then they decide what they're going to do.
I'm not going to do a full Rogers Firearms Corner on this, but they are using models, presumably, or blank firing replicas that look basically like the right weapons for that sort of force in that sort of period, which is... I mean, it's not much, but a lot of films don't bother, particularly films set outside the US, so it's nice to see.
Well, as someone who knows something about it, you don't want anything to, you don't want anything to pull you out of it and think, well, that doesn't make sense. As often does in Roger's Aviation Corner, but it didn't here. So they then find a woman in a Range Rover, who is basically the only person
They're having a running fight.
Oh yes, they are. I've forgotten this yet. They are then attacked by the werewolves. Sean Pertwee is gutted and eviscerated. He suffers a nasty peritoneal perforation, which leads to intestinal herniation, and he's not having a great time of it. You assume, kind of by the rules of many films, he's now dead, but they push his guts back in. That's easier said than done without stitching it together because of the positive pressure. But anyway, they do bandage it up. And
you want some gaffer tape here, mate?
Yeah, well, that would work fine. I'm going to talk about super glue later. That was another one of those scenes, actually. Oh, super glue was first used in Vietnam. Okay, thank you for the Wikipedia entry on super glue.
Yeah, yes, it was invented for that purpose.
The
commercial stuff does have some interesting other chemicals which make it not a great choice, that, you know, possibly better than dying.
But it was invented for skin wounds, not for muscle there. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the way I see it, they basically would be stapling his skin together just to hold things in place.
Basically, yeah, he's still got a subcutaneous hernia. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Nick's medical coma, that would not work and you would die, except I will give him the benefit of the doubt because he has superhero healing werewolf properties. But his guts would still be herniated. They'd just be under the skin unless they stuck his muscle layer together, which wouldn't work because it needs to be much drier than it is. Anyway, doesn't matter.
But anyway,
I'll let it go.
So, I mean, we should probably go with the main plot first before the bits we're complaining about. You know, they having this running firefight, they do eventually come across a woman driving a car and flag her down and, get her to take, well, basically, they're not perhaps thinking entirely clearly right now, but basically she says, I'm going to my place and they agree that they will go on with that. She's visiting friends or something. Anyway, this is the closest house.
She's going to warn some family in the area.
This is the closest house. That is the key thing.
The only house for 300 miles or however.
So they go there. And the family is not there. Mm-hmm. There's still something out there howling in the woods. So they break in, and basically a large chunk of the film is them being defensive in this place.
And again, more sort of convoluted reasons why they can't just drive away or phone anyone. It's fine. It just feels a little... I mean, it's what I would do as a Call of Cthulhu dungeon master. But it works. It's fine. So basically then we're into, I guess I would say, Assault on Precinct 13 territory.
Yeah.
The bulk of the film is them defending themselves against these werewolves. And again, I... The problem for me at this point is Sean Pertwee's in bed for most of it, and I do feel the film dips significantly in quality when Sean Pertwee's not on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, they are trying to make Cooper the hero, and yeah, I mean, in terms of what he does, he is, but he doesn't really have the screen presence to carry that off.
He hasn't quite got the charisma. And we have Leon Cunningham, who is now recovering from his fatal injury and gradually getting more and more Alan Rickman. Only he doesn't quite have the campness of Alan Rickman to pull it off. You know, Alan Rickman does it with a twinkle in his eye.
Now I'm picturing how Alan Rickman would have played that scene, and it's glorious.
Exactly. Leon Cunningham just basically gets posher and posher as he recovers and as he becomes more and more evil. So they all hate him explicitly. He's a special forces guy, and that never really changes. It's never really explicitly stated, we know you're turning into a werewolf, but it becomes pretty clear through the film that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm just waiting for Sean Pertwee to recover. We have this kind of lauded scene, Nick's medical corner. And so during the assault of the farmhouse, the first one, Sean Pertwee gets his guts grabbed by a dog, and then pulled out, and he's trying to pull them back. And I don't know if this is supposed to be a comedy moment or what. It's just,
I think it must be. Intestines do not work like that.
Well, that's my problem. The intestines don't have that kind of, stretchy. They, you know, they are cohesive, but you can pull them in. Don't ask me how I know, but you can pull intestines in half with your hands if you try hard enough. So a dog pulling on it, again, yeah,
there is a splendid moment in a Chris Brookmeyer book, early one, in which somebody uses a recently slain enemy intestines as a climbing rope to get across from one building to another. And yeah, it's a lovely moment, but I'm sorry. You go, argh, splat.
Yeah, exactly. It's similar to me. It took me right out of it in the same way Indiana Jones 4, where he's pulled out of the quicksand with a snake. And I just, that's not how things work. And even the most
manly snake.
The dog would have just bitten the intestines in half. And yes, maybe they're werewolf intestines and werewolves have super stringy, strong intestines. To me, that wasn't funny. That was just like this. That's not how it would work.
Also, on a practical level, it's not the world's best prosthetic.
Yeah, it's like a weird, yeah, it makes me think, I am watching a film and the director is trying to do a funny Tarantino moment or something. So it really, that didn't work for me at all. But, that's the one moment Sean Pertwee was on screen that didn't work.
and then he admits that he is sufficiently wounded that he has to go and lie down for a bit.
Yes, yeah, he has a bit of a lie down, while he recovers. And then we sort of, I don't know, there's a lot, I felt, this bit went on a bit. There was a lot of talking and tactics and discussion of plans. And I feel like this is where you get to know the characters. Like, you know, in Assault on Precinct 13, we know all the characters now. We care about them. But at this point, the character I mainly cared about was in bed upstairs. Megan, so Emma Cleesby's character, Megan, I don't know. How do you feel about our sole female character?
Well, okay, I'm going to say great big spoilers here, even by the standards of Ribbon of Memes.
Yes, spoiler.
But we do need to discuss this, because everything about her, I mean, including elements of her appearance, she spends a fair amount of time in a vest. Yes. All the visual grammar and the way she's acting is setting her up as the Ripley.
Yes,
not even the final girl, but specifically the Ripley.
Who
does something brave and violent at the very last moment when all the men have failed.
Yes.
And then it turns out that she has, A, knows a whole lot more about what's been going on than anybody else.
Yes.
But B, has made a perfectly sensible decision that she was hoping she could use these soldiers to get away from this mess. She has been turned herself, as has everybody else nearby.
Well, it turns out the whole family of the house that they're living in is a family of werewolves. She is one of that family.
Well, she has been brought into it.
Yes, yes.
But having decided that they are not, in fact, able to escape, sets things up so that they use a bunch of their resources on a futile attack.
Mm. Which she knew was never going to work.
Now, As far as her acting is concerned, it's very effective indeed.
Yes.
It just felt not quite enough.
I agree. It didn't quite well. I mean, it's a really good bait and switch. It's a great idea that,
the first time I saw this, yes, it was a surprising betrayal for me.
Well, I've seen this before and I'd forgotten it happened, so I was surprised all over again. But yes, it's really well, but something about it didn't quite work for me. Maybe she wasn't sold enough as the Ripley, because she's sort of conflicting with Kevin McKidd's character for like the hero protagonist, and it would have been, I don't know, would have been cool if she was pushed as the hero, but maybe that was it. But it just didn't quite work for me. But it is really good. I mean, it's a nice twist on the werewolf story.
The thing that did throw me though, because obviously up to this point, everything we've seen suggests that she is going to be helpful.
Yes.
But, okay, so assuming that she is what she is, and you know, she is going to help the soldiers initially, why did the other werewolves attack the Land Rover when she was in it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a sixth sense moment in that it doesn't really make sense in retrospect. It's one of those movie twists that kind of, okay, that's brilliant, but it doesn't quite hold muster.
And if it's a matter of all the other werewolves entirely lose control, why does she not entirely lose control?
Yeah, why is she not a werewolf when everyone else is, if she's been a werewolf for long? There's a lot of not entirely making sense.
And the individual scenes are great, and they work as the individual scenes, but they don't quite string together for me.
Well, through this film, she is great in it, and it's a nice twist. Mm. The other characters, I couldn't name any of the other soldiers, I'm afraid. They vaguely develop one dimension or maybe two during the last, mainly because there's fewer of them, so you get to recognise their faces a bit. And particularly the guy who does the suicide run to get chased. I feel like in a Spielberg film, in a Tarantino film, in a more skilled director, writer's hands, these characters would have been the story. They would have been what we cared about. You know, we're down to a few. In The Thing, you know, you know all these characters. And you don't like all of them, but you know them. And we have Liam Cunningham as the baddie. We have Kevin McKidd as the hero. We have Megan as the woman. but she's supposed to be like the hero woman. And we have Sean Pertwee. And then everyone else is just sort of extras. I don't know. It didn't quite work for me to sell it all. But then the film gets better again because Sean Pertwee feels better and gets out of bed.
I am going to argue that it's not so much a specific moment, but in general, the lighting here. I mean, okay, fair enough. It is an isolated cottage. The power has been cut. If they even had power in the first place, it's not clear. Mm. But they don't have power now. They're working with candles and, you know, what they can drag up.
I like that they search the house for silver, don't find a single, because you expect them to melt something down to make silver. There isn't any silver because it's a house full of werewolves. And of course they don't have any silver. Oh, that was a nice touch. Sorry.
But it's all very dark. There is reasonably good and subtle lighting for the scenes where they're talking to each other about stuff. You know, you can see who's talking, that's fine. But whenever anything starts moving, it's here is a silhouette of a body. Here is another silhouette of a body falling backwards. Except the incredibly bright moon.
yes, a staple of werewolf films, but yes, it can be quite bright on a moonlit night, but not that bright.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw that particular shot, you see it quite a bit, even though it is supposedly over a space of several hours, the light doesn't move. I assumed it was meant to be an outside light that was still operating for some reason.
It is meant to be the moon. Yeah, well, they have to have some light. I mean, I a lot of that is budgetary. You know, this was a really low budget film, and I think they make the use of their lower budget probably better than Ginger Snaps.
Possibly,
did.
Yeah.
And the werewolves are more successful, probably when you see them. They're less distractingly bad.
I also felt that it was a bit 28 days later in the framing of the fights. You know, there is clearly violent, manly stuff going on, but you don't really get a sense of what the stakes are in this particular instant. You know, I am reaching for the thing because I want to do the whatever, but he doesn't really get that.
Well, that is another issue for me of the fact that there isn't, for that kind of, you know, really claustrophobic, tight siege film, it's the little things that matter. Was the window latched? Did I put my gun on my left side or my right side? Where is the knife? It's those little things that can really make the story, little pedantic details, and there isn't really a lot of sense of place of that here. They're in a bathroom that I didn't know about, and suddenly and they're knocking through a wall. Oh, I didn't realize he was on the other side of the wall to him, and I didn't know. I agree. So partly the action is a bit muddled, but also the sense of place, I feel, I didn't quite get how big this place was or where they were in it or what was happening in any room at all.
I mean, I'm not demanding to see them constantly going up and down stairs, but I was under the short-term impression that the kitchen was actually upstairs at one point.
Yeah, well,
just because of what was happening when.
So then we graduate to the sort of final assault, and it really does work for me again because it's Sean Pertwee. But his kind of final sacrifice because he's turning. Then I did care about it. It worked well. I mean, as a story, I enjoy it. I mean, it feels like a B movie. And unlike Ginger Snaps, I mean, this is not trying to say anything clever or do anything clever. It is just a monster horror film. It's just done in a modern day environment with soldiers and good to a point dialogue.
And the reason I feel positively about this film is not it's a werewolf film, but it's a film about British soldiers being British soldiers, which is a thing we frankly don't see very often.
Yeah, and I wish I don't know enough about that. I don't know how accurate the portrayal was. It felt a little off to me. A lot of people say it is very good.
But... Well, I'm going to flash back to our Vietnamathon here. Where we were praising the firefights for being confusing because the people who are in them are basically draftees who haven't had much in the way of training, and it is utterly confusing and terrifying for them, and that was great. Yes. The firefights are confusing here, and I felt they shouldn't be.
I agree.
I mean, yes, it's not exactly what they've been trained for. They're taking way bigger casualties than they were expecting to, and so on. So, you know, there is that mental element of it. But they are also well-led. They've got a sergeant who knows what he's doing, and the job of the sergeant is to be a rock.
Mm. I think I would compare it a bit to Aliens, where you get the sense of, you know, the squad of Marines as the character. There are very few films that do characterization as well as Aliens, so I can't really compare. But the characterization is so good. You know, everyone's got that camaraderie. They follow order. They've got this green lieutenant, but I suppose what I'm trying to say is they behave like a proper squad of military Marines, Vietnam-era Marines in the case of Aliens.
Yeah, and it is specifically when the sergeant is suddenly taken out that they fall apart.
Exactly, but it worked up until that point where it all goes tits up and then they just collapse. Here, we never quite... And it's brilliant. Here, we never quite get the sense of them working as a team in that way. And I mean, I get that it goes wrong and the whales would survive, but I never get that feeling of these are people who've trained together and know each other well. And maybe they are a new group that's been put together, but it isn't really, or maybe they're the idiots of the army and they've been put right at the bottom, and that's what they would say.
I mean, what one of the things that Liam Cunningham reveals, and I don't think we have any reason to disbelieve it, is that what they were actually being sent out to do was attract the werewolves and become werewolf chow.
They're the bait.
At which point the Special Forces unit would sweep in and capture a werewolf and take it away for study.
Yes.
They thought there was one werewolf.
Yes, it turns out there's a family of them. As a team, they don't quite cohere. I would follow Sean Pertwee wherever he tells me to. So, you do get that sense. You know, they all look up to him. But it's a shame, I think, that he's taken out so early. And that's to give him the stuff later on. But I wish he'd had a less incapacitating injury. Mm. Anyway, overall...
A couple of military points I wanted to make.
Oh, yes, yes.
One, a field medical kit should have the really good painkillers in it, but it is not clear that any of these guys is actually a medic, so I will forgive them that.
I vaguely got an idea that Kevin McKidd's character was, but mainly that's because he does most of the medicing. But if he is, he's a fucking awful medic.
Is anything leaking? Stop it leaking.
This is basically military
first aid in a nutshell.
I will repeat the surgeon's mantra, all bleeding stops eventually.
One thing that did irk me a bit was what they referred to as stun grenades.
Oh, yes.
Because, A, this isn't quite the right term. Anybody in UK military service or police who actually use them more would call them flashbangs.
Right, so these are light grenades that's done using visual.
That's specifically the thing. I mean, yes, it is a flash and a bang. It's a very bright flash and a bang that does not sound like those bangs we heard. It's not throwing any fragments. It will occasionally throw some burning gas and set things on fire. If you remember the embassy siege that the SAS went into in London.
Oh, yes, yes.
That was how the fires got started. But basically what you're trying to do with the design of one of these is produce a tall but very short pressure wave. So a bang rather than a bang.
These, in my non-military part, they seem to go off like fragmentation grenades or something along those lines.
The thing is, what it should sound like is a crack like a gunshot.
Right.
Not a bang like a normal grenade.
And these were very much doing the normal grenade thing.
And they were also throwing people around, which grenades just don't do.
No, they just lacerate you to death, generally.
I know. I sent you that video of somebody throwing a flashbang.
Oh, yes.
And it's just not like that, and I don't know whether...
I get why they were on a training mission, but you, yeah.
Well, no,
yeah.
No, that's not clear. They're not in regular military use. That's the thing, even as training.
Right.
Very much more often you would use a smoke grenade, which does not incapacitate you at all, but makes it very clear where the thing has landed. So you can say, okay, I am next to that. I am now exercise dead.
Yeah. And there could have been some cool cinematic uses of that, I did, but yeah.
Guys were SAS trying to, or similar, trying to capture a werewolf, I can quite believe they would have used flashbangs. So they could quite plausibly be in the looting off that unit.
Even I noticed these things just look like normal grenades with what they do, except they don't really hurt anyone. So yeah, I found it a bit distracting that they used them at all, because they have no plot significance whatsoever.
I mean, you could just have said grenades.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't have thought much about it.
Anyway.
Yeah. Overall, it is I can see why it was popular. It's a fun B-movie. I saw this before. I enjoyed it the first time. I enjoyed it a bit less this time. I think I was less impressed. I'd looked into sort of Neil Marshall's latest oeuvre. Or is that Eggs? Can never remember. Neil Marshall's later Eggs. I haven't seen The Descent. The others he's done seem to be quite unpleasant. And there is something...
Well, the Descent is female-led, but that in turn means because it's a horror film that's putting the woman in terror practically all the time.
yes, which is what...
And even if that works as for the character, it's not a thing I feel entirely comfortable watching.
I'm not in a rush to... I was slightly turned off by some things in this film that just felt a bit... I don't know, unpleasant, amoral. I wasn't sure. I just got a distasteful feeling from some parts of the film, and I can't really put my finger on it. But it has, it makes me feel not entirely surprised that his other films seem to have gone a little bit in that direction.
Well, a positive thing, you know, yes, all right, there is only one female character, but she is not sexually menaced at any point by anybody, which is, you know,
yes,
something.
Yeah, I don't think it was misogynist. Yeah, I agree. I mean, as a first feature, that's very good. I can see why everyone raved about it. But it is ultimately just a B-movie to me. It's a horrible thing. And we like just a B-movie. You know, we love Ghost of Mars.
I mean, for me, it's very hard to place this above or below Ginger Snaps. They each have things that appeal to me. They each fail in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I put them quite close together on my overall rating if I had one.
Yes. Both considerably lower than Cat People, as well. But I think most of them are. The only one that comes close to me really was American Werewolf. But it's still not as good. Anyway.
I have some final werewolfy thoughts at least for now, the end of our werewolf-a-thon or Aru-a-thon. I mean, the werewolf is one of those classic horror film monsters like the vampire, but it's much easier to make a vampire film because he's basically a pale aristocrat.
So you need some prosthetic teeth and some
you need a good
blood.
Costume, some prosthetic teeth, some fake blood. Yeah. And ideally a good actor. But a werewolf needs... you've got to have at least one convincing fur job.
That sounds absolutely terrifying.
You've got to have a transformation scene.
I think people go generally, or at least used to go to werewolf films for the transformation scene. That may be less now, but I think audiences were expecting it.
So certainly in the 80s ones, I think that was definitely something that was needed. Werewolves are often in packs, whereas vampires can be alone, so maybe you even need several costumes. Mm. One thing that's changed, I think, a vampire is exotic foreign menace that is coming home into your nice safe place. I mean, that's all the way back to Dracula.
Yes.
And I think the vampire films we've seen are mostly about that. You know, here is a mundane world that you are living in, and now it's got vampires in it.
Yes, though they can be the haunted house variety if you go into their lair rather than they come into it. But as you say, the OG Dracula does both ways.
Werewolves can be the dangerous thing in the wild places. And then regarding American Werewolf in London as relatively early, it is also the dangerous thing that follows you home. I mean, in The Howling, it's also the dangerous thing that follows you home.
Well, I feel like werewolves are more, you know, a vampire is an external threat for the most part. I mean, we have had films that have explored the vampire's perspective, much to their credit. But werewolf movies, on the other hand, and it's a voluntary thing quite often, the vampire change. Whereas werewolves are like this involuntary, it's often about, you know, the beast within humanity and the change with it, the darkness inside rather than an external darkness coming in. It's bringing out the darkness within humanity.
So it can be fear of what's already in you. It can be fear of contamination, disease, and so on. I mean, I'm a big fan of the system Ken Hite laid out in GURPS Horror for fourth edition of basically classifying various kinds of horror threat as fear of the foreigner, disease, yourself, what you might do, that sort of thing.
Yes.
But I do think that a werewolf and indeed a vampire can spread across those in some respect.
They can and have to. I mean, there's only one film that nails all of those fears together, and that's Teen Wolf. But we have Teen Wolf gets an honourable mention. I've very happy memories of it. I don't want to see it again because I probably not enjoy it. And so I think we'll leave it there. Other honourable mentions: we never watched Wolf. And we didn't watch the many Howling sequels.
I mean, we're not
never watched the original Werewolf in London either. By all accounts, isn't wonderful.
Yeah, I have seen that before, and I was not rushing to bring it back to our watch list. I'm not saying we will never watch another werewolf film, but this is the end of our werewolf-a-thon, and we will get back to more normal films about normal people doing normal things.
I know what you're watching now. Oh, goodbye, everyone. Beware the moon.